Everybody, welcome to the second lecture. Hello. So today I would like to start discussing the basics of statistical physics. I hope it will be mostly review for you, but I'll try to do things slightly differently, maybe to what you have seen before. So part B of the chapter one, basics of statistical physics. And so, of course, typically what people do is that they start with a classical system and then they build a theory for the classical system. And then once you are familiar with the classical system, how it behaves, then you say, well, actually, it's more subtle, it's quantum mechanical. So let's see how we can actually upgrade these things to quantum mechanics. So let me proceed precisely the other way around. So I will start with quantum mechanics. I will do the quantum mechanical derivation of Gibbs distribution. And then, of course, specifying to classical thing will be then simple. OK, so we will build towards the Gibbs distribution as derived in quantum statistical physics. So part one, quantum versus classical. And so we are using the fact that the nature is inherently quantum mechanical. So I'll have to review some aspects of quantum mechanics for you. So a quantum system you want to describe two kinds of states. One of them is the microstate, which is really, you know, the microscopic description of the state, and the other one is the macrostate. Okay, so a microstate. So in quantum system, a microstate is described by pure state. And of course, that pure state lives in a Hilbert space. Okay. On the other hand, so this is a microstate, and it really, you know, is described by a vector in the Hilbert space. If you want to describe a macrostate, corresponds to the density matrix. And so the density matrix row is, if you want, just a collection of pure states where you say there is, to each such pure state, there is assigned probability that you will find that pure state there. So this density matrix has the following form. You sum over all possible states, and then you have the probability that the state happens, and then you have the state here. Okay, so this is the form of a density matrix, and this is the probability that the corresponding pure state psi lambda actually happens. So in this sense, the density matrix sort of describes an ensemble of pure states. Okay, so this is an ensemble. So row describes a statistical ensemble of quantum states. Okay, so now I know that you are all familiar with this density matrix because basically the first course and the front end was really focused on describing the density matrix. So there are some useful properties of the density matrix which we'll use. So one of them is that the density matrix is appropriately normalized. So we have trace row equals to 1. What is maybe more interesting is that how does the density matrix evolve in time? And that's described by von Neumann equation. So time evolution is described as follows. So d rho over dt is just 1 over ih bar, and then the Hamiltonian of the system, and rho. And this is von Neumann equation. Okay. So everybody's seen this equation. We can sort of prove it if you believe in Schrödinger equation, and you say that rho is just a pure state. So I'll just put psi lambda, and you use the Schrödinger equation and this verify this thing here. Of course, that's not a proof because, but it's a verification that it's true. So, okay. So this is the time evolution equation. Of course, all these quantities here are operators. So rho is an operator, and h is an operator as well. Okay. So now, once we know the density matrix, we can calculate the expectation values of any observables. So observable is an operator A. And if you want its expectation value, so expectation value is calculated as trace A times rho. A, this is the value, expectation value here. And this is defined or calculated as trace rho A. Okay, so that's basically what we need to know about quantum mechanics. I don't know what you spend the whole course about. So this is it. However, you don't need to use quantum mechanics all the time because most systems actually are in the classical regime. And so let us estimate, let us do very, very crude estimate for when actually we have classical regime and when we can trust that actually we don't need to use this machinery, but can use the classical description. So estimate. This will be one of the estimates you can do. So let me just do it very, very crudely. For validity of classical physics, so let's say I have a gas which is composed of molecules, and then I'm asking what are the momenta of these molecules, and what are the what is the volume each molecule basically has? And then I will use the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty to say, well, if delta x delta p is much, much, much bigger than h bar, I'm in the classical domain. OK, so term of fluctuations can be estimated as follows. Fluctuations. So I have the kinetic energy, which is momentum square over 2m. And I say this is given by my term of fluctuations. This is like equipartition theorem. So this is my temperature, and this is the Boltzmann constant. So that's the estimate for delta p. At the same time, I know that the distance in between the molecules, if you want, is something like the volume per molecule and the third root of that. So v over n, 1/3. So n is the number of particles, v is the total volume. And so this is my distance. And then what I require, of course, is that delta x, delta p, much, much bigger than h bar. And if this is true, then I'm approximately in classical regime. OK. So what is this? So delta x is just v over n 1/3. Delta p is 2m kt square root of that. And this must be much, much bigger than h bar. So now, actually, you can square things to make it nicer. And then you can also introduce a density of molecules. So this would be like specific volume would be V over N, and 1 over specific volume is the number density. So I'll introduce N to be N over V. And then you can rewrite this equation as KT is much, much bigger than N to 2/3, and then H square over 2M. Okay? So this is our condition for classical physics to be valid. And then you see that certainly it will be valid if the temperatures are really high. So classical physics is okay if temperature is high. Or if the number density is really, really small. It's small. So unless you have very, very dense gases with very, very low temperatures, then actually you can always use the classical physics description approximation if you want. Of course, these will be violated in certain cases, but never on the surface of air, unless you have helium or something like that. For example, if you have neutron star, this will be violated because it's so dense that this is no longer true, and you have to use actually at least some features of quantum mechanics to describe neutron star properly. Okay. So is it a quantum mechanical description? This is basically some conditions under which we may expect that classical physics description is valid. So what is the classical physics description? So in classical physics, so again, we have to say what a microstate is. So a microstate describing n particles of our gas is described by the corresponding positions and momenta of these particles. And of course, they live in the phase space. So there's three positions, three momenta for each particle. So in total, it's 6n dimensional space. So particles describing n particles corresponds to a state or vector state in R to the 6n phase space. So basically, I have a dot in 6n dimensional phase space, and that describes very well my microstate. Of course, the time evolution of this microstate is just given by Hamilton's canonical equations. Okay, so time evolution of this point in the phase space is just given by Hamilton's equations. Okay. Of course, this would be extremely painful to do because you have 6n, where n is a large number of these equations. And even providing initial conditions for these equations would be extremely, extremely hard. So the problem actually seems completely untractable. However, actually more is more particles you have, the problem becomes simple because you can use the statistical physics description. So you will use a microstate description. So this is described by basically one function described by probability distribution, W. And of course, this will be a function on the phase space. So in principle, it is a function of all these Qs and all these Ps. But we will see there is a tremendous simplification of this. And we will actually see that basically what it is function of is just an energy of the system. OK, but we have to build towards that. So distribution W on phase space which basically parametrizes our ignorance of the system. So we are saying, well, actually, there's only certain probability that the dot is here, another probability that the dot is there, another probability that the dot is there, and so on. OK. And so there's a corresponding measure. Mu, which is just this W. As I said, in principle, it can depend on all these Qs, so Q1. Q2, Qn, P1, Pn. In principle, it can be a function of all these things. And then there is the integration measure on the phase space. And this is given by a very weird thing. So d tau n, well, of course, it's d3q, d3p, all of them. But there is a strange prefactor. So it's 1 over n factorial. Well, why not? We have n particles. That is 2 pi h bar to power 3n. Well, why not? And then that is d3p1, d3p2, d3pn, d3q1, d3qn. OK? So so now this strange prefactor here, you can think about it as just a conveniently chosen prefactor so that if you integrate over W over the whole phase space, you just get 1. Okay? So this prefactor in some sense is chosen so that an integral of W d tau n equals to 1. So we are saying that probability of finding the dot somewhere in the phase space actually is 1. Okay, so that makes sense. However, it doesn't really explain why there is 2 pi h bar. So it comes from quantum mechanics. And so you have to do very properly, and there are books about it, how you really translate the quantum mechanical thing, which has h bar in it, to a classical limit. Okay, and basically 2 pi h bar is the volume of the smallest cell you can have so that actually quantum so that you don't violate the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty. So really, I can have the smallest cell is delta x delta p is equal to h bar. And that's where this thing comes from. And this is just shuffling the particles, which you treat as identical particles in the classical limit. OK? So anyway, so if you don't like this prefactor, just assume that it is here so that the probability is actually 1. OK. So now, in the classical limit, we think of the statistical ensemble one way to think about it is like having a large number of boxes which correspond to a given microstate with a given macrostate. And so if randomly open one box, I find a microstate, corresponding microstate with probability mu. Okay, so I have lots of boxes. On average, well, all of them macroscopically look the same. So now if I look inside the box and I want to find what really is the microstate, then I'll find the corresponding microstate with this probability here. Okay, so that's the statistical description of these things. Okay, so now we have what a statistical ensemble is. Next, we need to know what the observable is, you know, what is the energy of the system and stuff like that. So observable of course is a function on the phase space. And so once you have this function, then you are interested in the average value, or average value of this is just calculated as an integral over that measure here. So it's a pq and then w pq. In principle, this can depend on time as well. I didn't write it before. D tau n. Okay, so this is how we calculate the average value of an observer in statistical ensemble in classical physics. So now we can really see the parallel here, what we are doing. So you can basically map one to one anything with what happens on the quantum side to anything that happens on the classical side. And so I have this table there. So something and then quantum and then classical. So our stage where everything happens. So here is the Hilbert space. H, here is the phase space. For n particles, then the way how you calculate things is that in one case, we just do the trace over these things. So say mass. How you do the math, how you do the calculations is just you trace things here. Well, trace is nothing else than sum. Sum is nothing else than integral, so you just integrate here. Okay, so d tau n. Then statistical ensemble in one case. It is described by the density matrix. Rho. In the other case, it's described by this probability distribution. Probability distribution. W. So now you know that this guy is normalized so that trace rho is equal to 1. This guy is normalized so that integral w d tau n is 1. So now you have observable, and I'm running out of space, sorry for that. So here it is an operator. here. It's a phase-space function. Function APQ. And how you calculate what you actually measure is the expectation value or average. So here, A is just trace row A. And here is just an integral A W d tau n. OK, so this is the table which we'll use all the time. And I think it's pretty believable that actually you can do these things. Of course, if you want to do it really technically correctly, you spend lots of pages of books. So I know books which really discuss this whole thing. Like the whole book, 500 pages, just discusses this thing a little bit more rigorously. So, but intuitively, it must be correct. OK. So of course, this is for a, if you want, continuous degrees of freedom. But if you want to study, I don't know, classical spin chains or whatever, then everything becomes suddenly discrete. And so for example, typically what happens is that the integral becomes a sum and stuff like that. OK, questions? Very good. So now this was part A. So we will really use this table to translate everything which is done on quantum to classical. So we can basically, I'll show you how this works for something which is quite nice. So I told you that at quantum level, you have this time evolution of the density matrix described by the von Neumann equation. So now the corresponding classical limit is actually Liouville's equation. A Liouville's equation, very, very powerful, tells you a lot of things about the properties of the phase space. So part two, Liouville's equation. So I would like to start with that von Neumann equation, which basically tells you, well, so von Neumann which is the time evolution for the density matrix. But it basically expresses just one simple fact that the quantum mechanics is unitary. And there is a unitary evolution to quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics is unitary. Okay. So that's what actually von Neumann equation tells us. So now you want to do a classical limit of this. So classical limit. This equation. And so you know that, for example, if you see 1 over I h bar q and p equals to 1, then in the classical limit, you just forget the h bar and you change the commutators to Poisson brackets. So you just replace this with q and p. And similarly, if you have f hat, g hat more generally, then you replace that with I h bar f and g. Okay, so it's just basically the same statement. So now let's use it. So we know that the density matrix rho translates to our probability distribution w. So we are getting out of that is dw over dt is equal to, so now we have 1 over ih bar, and then we have the commutator or something. And the prescription is put ih bar and put a Poisson bracket there. So ih bar, and then the Poisson bracket. Of course, h is h, but now classical limit of our operator h and hw. Okay, so this is the classical limit of von Neumann equation. This is gone, as it must. In classical limit, we cannot have any h bars there. And so we have a beautiful equation that, and if you remember from classical mechanics, then if I put this guy on the right-hand side, then everything on the left-hand side is just dw, the total derivative with respect to time. Okay, so now we have dw over dt, which is dv over dt. Plus, now I use that this guy is antisymmetric, so I can swap the two things so that I don't pick up a minus sign, w and h. But it tells you that this guy is equal to 0. And this is Liouville's equation. Okay. Of course, what I'm doing here is the only correct way to do it. So you cannot derive from Liouville's equation the von Neumann equation, but you can derive from von Neumann equation the Liouville's equation. Quantum theory is more fundamental. And so you can get in a corresponding classical limit, you can get the correct equation in classical physics. And from classical physics, you can only motivate how the quantum theory looks like. Okay, so this is our von Neumann equation. By the way, it's shown in the lecture notes. And this equation is nothing else than just a continuity equation in the phase space. So you can really understand this. This term is something like divergence of some current. And then you can interpret this equation that something is flowing in the phase space. The probability distribution is sort of flowing in the phase space. Let me not do that. However, let me do two consequences which are interesting. And so one of them, very, very important for statistical physics. So consequence. For statistical physics, so just knowing this thing here, you notice that the total derivative of w is equal to 0. Okay, so in other words, w is an integral of motion, an integral of motion along the trajectory. And so we can solve it by, for example, taking w equal to constant. Okay, if you take the probability distribution is constant, in other words, that you are finding any microstate with equal probability, then this is a statistical ensemble which you can use, and it's called microcanonical. So microcanonical ensemble, probably conceptually the simplest one ever, because you just say, well, I'm finding any microstate with equal probability. So that's very, very simple. That's how Boltzmann formulated this equation. I have that many states because they have all same probability. But unfortunately, for calculation purposes, this is a nightmare. And the nightmare is because you have to work with some distributions. You are always at a fixed energy. Nothing fluctuates, everything is actually settled down. And so you can do it, but calculationally it's actually pain. So pain for calculations. Okay. So now another possibility is that w is a function of integrals of motion. If it's a function of integrals of motion, only integrals of motion, then each, of course, does not evolve in time. And so w will not evolve in time. So now the question is, which integrals of motion I have in general? So now everybody knows Runge-Lenz vector for Kepler's problem and stuff like that. So probably Runge-Lenz vector is not a good integral of motion for our w. And the reason is that, that Runge-Lenz vector only exists for, if you want, motion in a fixed spherical potential. So you have sort of like two-body problem. But here, you are dealing with n-body problem. Okay, so more particles you put, actually, that it's more likely that you will use you will lose exceptional integrals of motion. Okay, so Runge-Lenz vector is a luxury which exists only for two-body problem and very, very specific potential 1 over r. But if you start putting more particles, suddenly such integrals of motion will not exist. Okay, so then you are basically guaranteed to only have integrals of motion which come from the symmetry of the space. Okay, so in general, this W will be a function of energy, momentum, and angular momentum. So these are really the integrals of motion you are guaranteed to have, because of and every other integral of motion which may exist is probably lost because I have now weird potentials, I have many particles, so you don't get these integrals of motion. However, this one is not really interesting because you can also always go to a frame which is actually commoving with the fluid or commoving with the gas. So this one is not interesting because I can go to that frame. This one is also not interesting because I can go to a co-rotating frame. Okay, so these two, not interesting. And you can go to a frame where actually my total momentum is zero and my total angular momentum is zero. Okay, I can co-rotate with the gas. And so we have that W is a function of E only. So now this is amazing simplification, isn't it? So at the beginning I told you W is any function on the phase space, it's a function of 6n variables here. But now I'm telling you as a consequence of Liouville's equation, actually we know that it's only a function of energy of the system. And so this is beautiful. So now let's take two non-interacting systems, one and two, and put them together. So then, so two systems, and then you calculate the probability distributions for both of them, and if they are non-interacting, it's just a product of the two probability distributions. Well, this is an amazing formula because we can take a logarithm of this formula. Okay. 1, 2 is logarithm of W1 plus logarithm of W2. Okay. So now, if you know what you need to get, and you know that W is only a function of energy, and you know that if the systems are non-interacting, then the total energy is, of course, sum of the energies. Okay, so it looks like a sum of energy 1 plus energy 2 equals to the total energy. Okay, so we are setting that this is equal to beta E equals to beta E1 plus beta E2. So E is the total energy of the two systems. So this will be true if this is equal to and if this is equal to where beta is, you know, some constant which multiplies this. Okay, so looks like sum of energies and in fact it is. So what you have derived is that logarithm W is actually beta E, or that W is E to beta E. Okay, so this is the Gibbs distribution. So Gibbs distribution for canonical ensemble. Okay. So you see that basically you derived the Gibbs distribution from the von Neumann equation, which gives rise to Liouville's equation, which gives rise to this argument here. Okay, so I'll redo this derivation in the quantum mechanical setting, but I think it's really, really nice to see that really out of this it already follows that we have to have distribution like that. Okay, so now a second consequence of Liouville's equation is the Liouville's theorem as we know it from classical mechanics. So another consequence is Liouville's theorem. So remember, Liouville's theorem is what we discussed is that we had the cat in the phase space, and then as we evolved in time, the cat got deformed, but in the end, it preserved its volume. Okay, so it got squashed, it got stretched, but the volume of that cat remained the same. So we have how does this follow from this theorem here? Remember that we have the normalization of the probability distribution, so we know that this is 1. Okay. So now let us take time derivative of this. Okay, d over d tau applied on this thing here. So now, of course, if I apply d over d tau on 1, I get 0. So 0 equals 2. And here I pull it through the integral. So I have two terms. So I have dw over dt d tau n plus wd over dt of d tau n. That's so many dt's. Okay, so this must be true if I'm taking the time derivative here. And so look, through the Liouville's equation, I know that the probability distribution is preserved in time. So this term is equal to 0. And so what I conclude, so now I have 0 equals to w d over dt d tau n. So I have to conclude that d over dt of the measure in the phase space is equal to 0. So in other words, the volume element does not change as I evolve in time. So this is this is the cat picture. So this is the Liouville's theorem as we've seen it. And of course, if you integrate over finite thing, then you are getting precisely the cat, right? So the volume does not change. You know that the volume, so you are doing some canonical transformations, and so the volume actually transforms, and there's some Jacobian. And what we are saying is that the Jacobian actually equals to 1, so that the volume doesn't change. And so that's the proof of here through the Liouville's equation. So now this is really beautiful if you just think about what's actually happening here. So one thing is that we derived the Liouville's theorem in classical mechanics as a consequence of the fact that actually the time evolution in the phase space is a Hamiltonian vector field. Okay, so we had some special vector fields in the phase space, and so as a consequence, we had the Liouville's theorem. Here, we are deriving this thing as a consequence of the fact that quantum mechanics is unitary theory. Everything follows from the fact that quantum mechanics is unitary theory. So basically, behind Hamiltonian vector fields, you can think that there is unitary evolution of quantum mechanics. Okay. Questions? Yes?
If something's a measure, like what exactly is the significance of saying that?
Sorry? Something measure?
Yeah, if you call something a measure, what are the properties we're saying?
I don't know. I'm not a mathematician. So, but basically what it says is, what I have to put in the integral to integrate things properly. Right? So measure, I don't know. Can anybody tell me what are the properties of the measure? Probably you want something that is positive, definite, and stuff like that. Yeah. Well, open any book on calculus of many variables or whatever. Yeah. Okay. So that's the Liouville's thing, and so this was just a consequence of the fact that we have a unitary evolution. So now let's do really the statistical physics, and let's do it quantum mechanically. So path three is the Gibbs distribution. So I have put a preliminary list of questions for the interview on the wiki. And so it's not guaranteed that all the questions will be there, and it's not guaranteed that there won't appear any more questions, but it's just a preliminary list of questions. But certainly one of the questions is the Gibbs distribution. So here, if you pay attention here, you can at least answer one of the questions in the interview. So we have basically derived the Gibbs distribution for the canonical ensemble just using this argument. But let me rederive it from completely different starting point. And so we start with a definition. And again, you can spend half of the course on motivating this definition, but I'll just put the definition. So we define a statistical or von Neumann entropy . So again, I am using the quantum mechanical description here. So statistical von Neumann entropy is defined as S minus K times trace rho log rho. Very, very important formula. So if I have density matrix rho, I just define a quantity S, which is given by here. And as I said, you know, we can motivate it, you can, but anyway, in the end, it's a definition. So now, since now on, I'll always set k equal to 1, so you will not see any more k's in this course. So this is k equal to 1. Okay. So now, if you want to describe a system, you typically want to describe a system provided some external conditions are true. So in other words, provided that I measure some observables to have some expectation values. So assume that system has some observables. And there's many of them, so I'll call them AI. Okay. And then let's say in general there is n of those observables. And so these are operators in that Hilbert space. And so that they have expectations values, have expectations values. Small AI. Of course, these are given by the formula there, so AI is just trace rho AI. So now the problem is, and at the same time, I know that my density matrix is normalized. So now the problem which you are asking is, well, let's say I have a system which I know is in thermodynamic equilibrium, or in equilibrium. And at the same time, I know some things about the system. So I know that, for example, the energy takes some average value A1. I don't know, something else, pressure or whatever, takes some other expectation value A2 and so on. So now we are asking a question, what is the corresponding density matrix which describes my system? And the answer to this question is given by the principle of maximal mass. You always want to make as much mass as you can. So remember that. It's a good thing for your life. So principle of maximal mass so now it tells you what this density matrix has to be. So the density matrix rho representing the equilibrium state. The equilibrium state of a microsystem is such that it maximizes the statistical entropy provided to the constraints which we have above the system. Be macroscopical. Constraints over here. These constraints. Okay, so that's a principle of maximal mass. So I always want to maximize the statistical entropy defined here, provided that these constraints are satisfied. So now, of course, this leads to a variational principle. So now, not only classical mechanics, you can formulate in terms of a variational principle, but also statistical physics. So what you want to actually extremize or maximize is the following functional. So we want to extremize my functional I, which is given by our statistical entropy, but it's subject to these constraints. If you have constraints in your system, remember the classical mechanics lecture, then you add Lagrange multipliers and you put these constraints in. Okay, so then you have minus sum over I lambda I, and so lambda I are the Lagrange multipliers, and then you put the constraints, so phase rho AI minus AI, these are these constraints, and then you also have a constraint on the density matrix phase of rho minus 1. Okay, so this is the functional you want to extremize. And of course, you are looking for the density matrix. So the thing to vary in this functional is the density matrix. Okay. So let's do it. So delta I, so of course delta S, and then minus sum over I, lambda I, they are just Lagrange multipliers, they are not varied here. And then we have trace of AI delta rho. And then it's minus AI is just a constant, so you don't vary that. So that's it, like that. And then it's minus lambda 0 trace of delta rho. So we are doing something, you know, mathematically quite wild, right? So we are just varying. So remember, these are operators, right? So, but let's treat them as numbers, right? So let's treat them as normal thing. So we are doing this. So now, what is delta S? So S is the definition over there. So it's minus trace, and now you have rho log rho. So I have to use the Leibniz rules. I have delta rho log rho, delta rho log rho. And then if I differentiate the other one, if I differentiate the logarithm, I get 1 over rho and delta rho. So 1 over rho eats rho, so I have plus delta rho. Okay, so that's what delta S is. Oh, very good. So now we want to group all the terms together and put everything inside the trace. So let's see if we can do it. So this is equal to, so there'll be a trace here. Okay, so it's now it's minus logarithm of rho minus 1 minus lambda I AI, that is still the sum, doesn't matter. And then it's minus lambda 0, and the whole thing is multiplied by delta rho, and hopefully I didn't make a mistake. Did I? It's minus, 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 minus. Is this okay? Okay. So we have that, and we know that this must be equal to 0, because the variation, well, the action is stationary. So now, if I call this thing a new operator B, then you are getting an equation that trace of B times delta rho equals to 0. Okay. Now it takes your friend, mathematician friend, to say actually, well, what is the solution of this equation? This must be true for any delta rho. But however, delta rho is not any matrix. If delta rho were any matrix, then actually you can conclude that B is equal to 0. However, rho is a Hermitian matrix. It satisfies rho equal to rho Dagger. So there is some subtlety with that. But the conclusion is still the same. So actually, you have to conclude that B equals to 0. Okay. So in other words, logarithm of rho is equal to, oh no, this is all these minuses, which is probably fine. So it's minus sum over I, lambda I, AI, minus 1 plus lambda 0. Or if I exponentiate that rho is the exponential of, so now, again, these are operators or matrices or whatever. So now this is just a unit matrix. This is unit matrix, and this is unit operator times something. So I can put it in front of these things. It would be e to minus 1 plus lambda 0, and then e to minus sum over I lambda I AI. Okay, so this is what rho is. It still looks a little bit ugly. So we have to now impose, well, we can now use these constraints here if you want. So one of these constraints is that you require the trace rho is equal to 1. So now let's impose that. So if I do trace on this thing, I'll have trace rho. Well, this is just a number. So it's e to minus 1 plus lambda 0 times trace of e minus lambda I AI. But you know that this must be equal to 1. So in other words, if I call this thing just a shortcut z, then I find that this e to minus 1 plus lambda 0 is actually 1 over z. So e to minus 1 plus lambda 0 equals to 1 over z. So that's what I found here. Okay. So now this guy is just 1 over z. And you derive that rho is 1 over z e to minus sum over I lambda I AI. So this is the density matrix, which is consistent with all these constraints, and which maximizes the corresponding function. So now this density matrix is called generalized Gibbs distribution. It's the most general Gibbs distribution you can ever think of. It has all possible variables which may be consistent with my macroscopic state. And function z, which is just trace of that, so z, which is, again, let me write it, it's trace of e minus sum over I lambda I AI, this thing here, is called partition function. Okay, so I think it's very nice that you can formulate this variational principle and you can derive this Gibbs distribution in this way. Questions?
Why should the density metric depend on the observable?
Why not? So remember, I am trying to find a density matrix such that it describes my macro state, which is constrained by these things, right? So I'm really constrained. I'm saying, let's say I measure average energy. So of course, the energy will be just trace rho h, right? Where h is the Hamiltonian. So I want to describe a system which is consistent with the fact that my system has average energy e. Okay. So then it's of course natural that the Gibbs distribution, the corresponding density matrix, must depend on h, right? Because h enters that requirement.
Does it mean that the h should be the conserved quantity of the system,
Well, that means that in average I measure the corresponding energy. The average value of the energy will be.
But a doesn't have to be energy. It can be anything.
Exactly, it can be anything. So let's say I don't measure average energy. I measure something else. I thought that when you said why, at the end of the question, would be a very nice question. But I'll use that question later. Okay, so now we have the distribution, and we have a few properties which directly come from the formulas we derived. Yes.
Why do we want to get rid of that lambda knot? We rewrite it so we don't have to have that lambda knot up there anymore, but I don't know.
Well, in principle you can keep it, but you still have to impose. So in the end, so the calculation when you have the constraints typically proceeds that first I have to put them in the functional, as we did here. But once you vary everything, once you get the equations of motion, you can use the constraints to actually solve these equations of motion. In fact, they will be solving some equations automatically. So actually now I can use these constraints once I obtain the equation of motion. So our equation of motion is, well, you know, the solution is this thing here. So now you can use it. So now I can use that trace rho is equal to 1. I can demand it. And of course, you can solve it for something else. But why not to solve it for lambda 0? Right? Because the other lambda i's, well, you know, how would you solve for lambda 1, let's say? Because it's multiplied by a1, you cannot really do it. But for lambda 0, yes, you can. So now, immediate properties. OK, so let me just write down some of the properties. So if you look at the partition function z, then it is a function of anything. It is a function of lambda I, right? So it doesn't. So z does not depend on the small ais because they are defined here, but rather it is a function of small lambda i's. So now you may get a great idea to take logarithm of that and differentiate with respect to these lambda i's. And what you'll find out is that ai is actually minus d over d lambda I logarithm of that. So that's one property. Another property is that the entropy is just sum over lambda I ai plus logarithm of z. And finally, lambda I is just ds over d ai. Okay, so these are amazing properties which come from what we have derived. So let me just show maybe, well, okay. The first one, so let's calculate what I'm suggesting to calculate here. It's minus d over d lambda I of logarithm of z. So you differentiate the logarithm, you get 1 over z. This is minus 1 over z dz over d lambda I. So now we have to use what z is. So this is minus 1 over z, 1 over z. So z is some trace. I can put the derivative inside the trace. So it's trace of d over d lambda I of e minus lambda j aj So what it does is, well, it brings ai down. Okay, so this is equal to minus 1 over z trace, and it brings also a minus sign, so it'll be plus, and then ai e minus ai lambda, like that. Now, I pull 1 over z is just a number, just a function. I pull it through the trace. I can take this guy and put it here. Okay. So this is trace ai, and then it's e minus that divided by z, which, if you look at that, it's precisely rho. Okay. Rho, which is ai. So we proved the first one. You can prove equally the second one. It's done in the lecture notes, but you can do it yourself. It's just some practice to have. And once you have the second one, then all I have to do is I have to differentiate s with respect to ai. So which brings me here, if I differentiate the first term, it brings me lambda I, which is this thing here. And then you would be differentiating logarithm z with respect to ai. But z doesn't depend on a. So that's why it's 0. So the third equation comes from the second almost immediately. Well, immediately. So this is easy. And this is homework. Okay. Very good. Question. Okay. So now we have the general Gibbs distribution. So now let's discuss more special case of this. And so the special, really the most useful case is that of canonical distribution. So part 4 is the canonical ensemble. So this is a special case of a system where you just keep the average value of energy fixed. So the only of these observables AIs is the Hamiltonian, and the corresponding energy is fixed. Okay, so we have that the only observable is H, which is base rho H. So that's the only thing which is actually allowed to fluctuate. So only energy can fluctuate the only AI here is the Hamiltonian. And so the corresponding ensemble is called canonical ensemble. And the corresponding Lagrange multiplier to H would be lambda H. But lambda H people don't use. So they typically call lambda H beta. So lambda H is now renamed to beta, is the corresponding Lagrange multiplier. And so then our Gibbs distribution just reduces to something very simple, that rho is 1 over z, e minus beta h, where z is trace of e minus beta h. OK, so now this is the description of the canonical ensemble, where I just choose only one AI to be H. Alrighty, so now, so far, as I said, lambda h, or beta, is just a Lagrange multiplier. So, and this thing, actually, it's sort of waived, because the Lagrange multiplier is something arbitrary, really. As you remember, it is any function, or it's any thing, then there's no connection with physics, really. So to make the connection with physics, to really connect this s with the thermodynamic entropy, and to connect something with temperature and something with heat, you need to make connections with thermodynamics. Okay, so connections with thermodynamics. That's why we actually went through thermodynamics review in the first lecture. So we make the following definitions. To connect with thermodynamics, we make the following definitions. So we define the work to be trace of rho delta H. And we define heat to be trace of the other way around, so H d rho. Okay, so that's our definition. Once you do that, you may calculate what du is. So du, well, in our definition, is just d of trace of rho h. Okay, that's two terms by Leibniz rule. Trace of d rho and h plus trace of rho and dh. Well, and it's delta q plus delta w. Okay. It's delta q plus delta w. So this is the first law, provided that we call this one work and this one heat. So OK, why not? So we are recovering the first law with these definitions. It's obvious from the definition that this thing has units of energy, and this has units of energy. It's just, you know, it depends only on h and dimensionless rho. OK, so it has units of energy. So question is why you call one heat and why you call the other work. And the reason is that, OK, why is the question I liked. OK, so let's use it. Well, it's a definition, so there's no why. But you can sort of justify the definition. Well, you can motivate the definition. So this is really a definition. And you cannot argue its definition, but you can justify the definition or motivate it. So for example, I take rho to be sum over probabilities and now my states. So that's my density matrix. And at the same time, you take H in the same basis to be some energy levels. And then this thing here. So now if you calculate what delta Q is, so this is trace of H d rho. Well, okay. So now you have to multiply, so d rho, well, d rho, what it does is just puts d here. Okay, so this will be d rho. So this is trace, and then now there are sums. Okay, so it's delta Pm, and then M, and then M, and H is En, M, and N. And there are sums over M and N. So now you are in orthonormal basis, so M and N gives you delta Mn. And then you have M and M here, but you trace over that, and that gives you 1. Okay, so this is just sum over M, delta Pm, and then Em. Okay, so that's what delta Q is if you calculate it in this basis. And similarly, you would find that delta W looks precisely the same, but the delta is on the other term. So Pm delta Em. Okay, so now you can sort of see why it may be good to call one work and the other one heat. So in this guy, you are keeping the probabilities of the states the same, but you are changing the energy levels. Okay, so let's say I have many energy levels in the atom, and I just shift everything by something. I just change the energy levels. Okay, so this can easily be done by some conservative forces, for example, by electric field. Okay, so here I shift energy levels. And that can be done by conservative fields. That's why I call this work. On the other hand, here, I keep the energy levels untouched, but I change probabilities. So I somehow redistribute the probabilities. Oh, so this is something much more dirty, right? So you have to say, well, this energy level now has different probability than that one, than it had before. So this is dirty because we change probabilities. Change probabilities. And because it's so dirty, it's natural to call that heat. Okay? Well, it's true. very good. So this is sort of a motivation why you call one work, one heat. But after all, you know, you don't really care. You just define this one to be work and this one to be heat. Okay, so we recover the first law. So now, of course, to define temperature and entropy, we need the second law. Second law. So let us calculate what delta S is. as we define it here. So S is that thing, so this is just minus delta of trace row block row. Okay, so this is minus trace, so again, I differentiate the first one, I get delta row block row. And then I differentiate the second one, so I'll have rho 1 over rho delta rho. So it's trace of delta rho. Okay? But now remember that trace of rho is 1. If trace of rho is 1, trace of delta rho is 0. Okay? So it's minus trace of delta rho, but this is 0 because of the normalization. Of the density matrix. Okay, so we have that. So only the first term survives. So now this is minus trace delta rho. And I have to use what my logarithm of rho is. So we are in the canonical ensemble, which is nowhere here, it's here. So rho is this thing, it's 1 over z minus e beta h. So now if I take logarithm, I just get a minus beta h, and then minus logarithm of z. So it's minus beta h minus logarithm of z. Okay. So logarithm of z is a number. Delta rho. The trace of delta rho times logarithm z is trace of delta rho times logarithm of z, which is 0. Okay, so this term doesn't contribute because I'm again using that trace of delta rho is 0. And so this is equal to minus, so it's plus trace of delta rho beta h, which is beta times trace of delta rho of h. Which is beta delta q. Okay, so what you have found is that the variation of the statistical entropy is equal to the Lagrange multiplier beta times delta q. Okay, so now you have to use second law of thermodynamics, which is, for example, captured by Clausius' relation. So remind what we have seen yesterday. Clausius, it's all you need to know. I told you about thermodynamics. So Clausius' relation tells you that delta S is actually delta Q over T, where T is the thermodynamic temperature. So we have to identify the Lagrange multiplier beta is given by 1 over t. And so the second law really provides you. Yes?
Can you say again why the log z is 0?
Let me just write it here. So this is plus trace of delta rho beta h, and then it's plus of trace of delta rho times logarithm of that, right? So that's what it is. So now, remember, the logarithm of that is just a number. So I really can take it out of the trace. And so there'll be written like trace of delta rho times logarithm of that. But trace of delta rho equals to 0 because of the normalization. It's the same argument as here. So trace of rho. Trace of rho equals to 1. If I make delta on this, then I'll get 0. Okay, so we have that beta, the Lagrange multiplier, is 1 over temperature. And so that's the total description of the canonical ensemble. So we have that rho is E minus beta h divided by z, where beta is 1 over t. And that's the description of the canonical ensemble. So now we can make another definition. We can make a definition that the free energy is defined by minus t logarithm of z. So we form such a quantity here, and we call it free energy. Again, a definition. So now, of course, it would be nice if this free energy is the free energy we know from thermodynamics. OK, so the question is it? And if you look at one of the properties here, this one here, you prove this relation here. So S is lambda I AI plus logarithm of Z. So in our case, S, so the only lambda I is beta, it's beta H plus logarithm of Z, right? So that's how this relation now looks like. OK, so let me multiply by T. OK, so T is here, and T is here. T beta is gone because beta is 1 over T. Not H, U, right? So I'm taking the expectation value. OK, let me do it again. So S is beta U plus logarithm of Z. Now I multiply by T. So I have TS is equal to U plus T logarithm of Z. And so you find that I need a minus sign. But so if you put that guy here, then you're finding that F, so from the formula, we find that F is U minus TS. OK, so this F, as I define it here, is precisely a Legendre transformation of my internal energy. So it is the free energy. So S in thermodynamics. So this is a good definition of the free energy. And it precisely corresponds to the free energy as we know it in thermodynamics. OK, very good. So now this is basically all you need to know. We only discussed the canonical ensemble, where only the energy was allowed to fluctuate. But you can consider other other statistical ensembles. And there is a whole table I give you in the study text. But really, you don't really need to use them, because the trick is that you can show that in the thermodynamic limit, as the number of particles n goes to infinity, actually all the canonical, all these ensembles, they give you basically the same thing. OK, so sometimes it is useful to use a different one than the canonical one. But in the end, it doesn't really matter which one you use. So it would be a shame not to tell you about the grand canonical one. Grand canonical. So in this case, it's not only energy, but also the number of particles is allowed to fluctuate. And so the corresponding partition function is just given by trace of E minus beta H, and then plus beta mu n. And that's it. So n is the operator for particle number. So now I can actually fluctuate the number of particles. So for example, when you will be discussing on Friday in your tutorial photon gas, then the particle number, well, the number of particles of photons actually can fluctuate. It doesn't cost anything to create photons. So that's why they can fluctuate. So this is the corresponding operator. Beta is, again, 1 over T. And mu is the chemical potential. OK, so this would be the grand canonical ensemble, but there are many other ensembles. And yeah, but the canonical one is the most useful. Are there any questions? All right. I'll see you tomorrow.